Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Hi everyone, and welcome back to the Drive Nation podcast, now on episode 9. I'm Dan Prosser, on the other end of the line, as ever, Andrew Frankel. Hello, Andrew.
Hello, Dan. Good to hear from you. I'd like to say good to see you, but of course I can't, as ever. You're in Bristol, I'm somewhere in the middle of bloody nowhere, waiting for all this nonsense to end. But yes, back episode 9 of the podcast. Good to be here.
Yeah, well, we're sort of making progress, aren't we? I've been out and about a bit more this week, still under, you know, certain sort of restrictions, but it's been, we'll talk about it a bit more later on, but it's been such a relief to get back on the road, back in a couple of fast cars, and just sort of enjoying doing my job again.
Yeah, I bet. I wouldn't know myself. News of the slight relaxation lockdown has clearly not quite managed to penetrate the depths of the Wye Valley, but we'll get there, I'm sure.
Now, are you allowed to cross the bridge at the bottom of your village?
It depends for what purpose. So, yes, I do actually live in Gloucestershire, even though if you want to send me a letter, you have to send it to Monmouthshire. Because basically to get out of the village, I've got to go from England into Wales. So I guess it depends what purpose. And certainly, I guess the final destination has to be back in England again. So the answer to your question, I haven't got a bloody clue. and why the various nations of this country cannot sort of get their crap together and come up with some kind of common plan is beyond me. But there you go.
Clear as mud. Okay. Well, we've been, over the last few weeks, you and I have been recording standalone podcast specials, really. We've been choosing one subject and talking about it for 45, 50 minutes, whatever it is. The very first podcast that we recorded before lockdown, during that podcast, we introduced what we think is going to be the Drive Nation podcast format. We just haven't been able to do it because of the COVID-19 situation. But basically, this podcast, once everything is back up and running again, is going to be half podcast specials with, you know, the topics that we'll choose and talk about for an hour or so, and guests and all that good stuff. And then the other half will be a sort of topical news-based chat about everything that's been going on, and then also deep diving a small number of the most recent popular Drive Nation posts on Instagram at @DriveNation_. Now, we've only been able to do that particular format once, but there's been a bit more movement over the past few days. Restrictions in England, at least, have been lifted a little bit, so we've been able to get, or I certainly have been able to get back out in the cars. And then in the motorsport world as well, there's been a bit more news. So for this episode of the podcast, we're going to go back to that original format. We're going to talk for 20 minutes or so about all the latest goings on in the car and motorsport worlds, and then we're going to choose 3 or 4 Drive Nation posts to talk about in a bit more detail. So, Andrew, that's a very long way of saying that what we're going to start out with for this podcast episode is a chat about the Formula One driver musical chair scenario.
Yeah, I mean, who'd have thought it? Formula One's actually, the most interesting Formula One's been for a while is when Formula One's actually not happening. But Yeah, you know, a few days ago, for people who are listening to this, starting next Tuesday, we got the news, obviously, that it was all change at Ferrari and also at McLaren. And yeah, it's just going to be really interesting, isn't it? You know, you've got Ferrari with its youngest ever, I think, driver lineup. Coming. This is for the 2021 season, so obviously everything stays as it is for whatever 2020 season they're able to salvage after lockdown. But you've got Carlos Sainz joining Charles Leclerc at Ferrari, and do you know what? I'm really, really excited about it because I just don't know what's going to happen. I think that Leclerc, I mean, he's kind of regarded, isn't he? He's up there as a sort of Division 1 driver along with Max and Lewis. I guess they're the only two that I would say these days live at the absolute top level. And I don't think that Sainz is necessarily there yet. But then again, if you look at last season, you know, he came sixth in the championship, and you may think to yourself, well, that doesn't necessarily sound that high. But if you think, you know, that sixth behind, you know, both Ferrari drivers, both Mercedes drivers, and he actually, because Red Bull swapped drivers halfway through the season, he actually did better than one of those pairings. That's actually fairly extraordinary. And, you know, I think he's just one of these sort of slightly under the radar drivers, and I think that he could do some really, really interesting things. And I think those two are really, really going to spur each other on. It'll just be really interesting, given that Ferrari haven't necessarily had the greatest management skills over the years, how they manage having two young hotshots on their team. And then there's the McLaren side of it as well. So, yeah, very, very interesting. What do you think?
Yeah, Sainz is an interesting one because he's hopped around teams a lot, hasn't he? He's been in Formula One only for a handful of years, but I think he started at Toro Rosso and then he was in the Renault. I think that's right. And then he's with McLaren for a couple of years, maybe even only one actually, and now hopping over to Ferrari. But in all that time, he hasn't been in a frontline car. So, you know, perhaps he is one of these very bright young prospects. He just hasn't had the opportunity to demonstrate it yet.
It's a very interesting point because, you know, the point is that, and this is what I think people, including me, forget about Formula One, that if you remove the top three teams and you go and look at the battle for the midfield, it's a fantastic battle and no one ever focuses on it. You know, you go and look at Racing Point and McLaren and, you know, and Renault and that lot all, you know, competing, you know, very, very well against each other and very closely against each other. But, you know, for the last, well, okay, so it was Australia 2013, which is the last time anybody other than a Red Bull, a Ferrari or a Mercedes driver won a race. So really, if you don't drive for one of those three teams on any given Sunday, the best you're likely to do is seventh if they don't have problems or fall off or trip over each other or whatever. So given that context, I think he's done really well. But there are probably others too. There may be other drivers out there who, just given the equipment, would show us things we didn't think that they were capable of.
Absolutely. I think George Russell, people talk about him being one of those guys, perhaps Lando as well. I mean, I suspect half the drivers on the grid, if you stuck them in a Mercedes, they'd be winning races, possibly even all of them. Who knows? It seems a shame almost, doesn't it, that we still have whatever the 2020 season turns out to be to sit through, because with all the driver changes that we've seen, I just want to get stuck into the 21 season.
Absolutely. Completely right. You just want to say, well, just make the changes now. The 2020 season hasn't actually started yet. So just make the changes now, because it's going to be like sort of, you know, Prince Charles being king, when the entire country just wants him to, you know, step aside and have somebody actually sort of young and interesting and fun do the job. And we're going to have this sort of interregnum, aren't we, where, you know, it's going to be same old, same reg, same car, same drivers. And we know what's going to happen, don't we? You know, we just know what's going to happen. I just wish that they would, now that it seems that, you know, something genuinely interesting is happening in Formula One, why do we have to wait until, well, it's nearly a year, isn't it? It's going to be next March before we actually get to see any of it. And as you say, I mean, I think they're still hoping to have something like 18 races. I mean, goodness knows how. But yeah, I'm going to struggle to summon up the enthusiasm for that myself.
Yeah, agreed. I'm actually really looking forward to the 21 season now, and I wonder if Ferrari, you know, if science turns out to be a real hotshot, they've given themselves a huge problem, haven't they?
Well, in terms of who to back.
If science walks into that team, which is, it looks like it's going to be built around Leclerc now. If science walks into it and turns out to be mega quick and competitive, they've got two young, super talented drivers that they're going to have to try and manage.
Yeah, I mean, I think given where they've been, I think that they would categorise that under a pretty nice problem to have. Specifically because Sebastian Vettel, he's been interesting, hasn't he? Because, I mean, you know, this won't be news to anybody, but he has just never, his time at Ferrari, was he never quite given the right equipment? You see, I think he was. I think in 2018 he had the best car out there, but he wasn't able to convert it. And if you look at his time at Red Bull, he won back-to-back championships with an Adrian Newey car. You know, great news. But after he'd done that in the 2015 season, you know, this young lad called Danny Rick turns up.
It's 2014.
Blows him into the weeds, wins, yeah. You know, three races, Sebastian wins none. Next thing that happens, Sebastian's off. So, yeah, I mean, maybe he's a busted flush. And what's he going to do? Is he going to stay in F1? I really, really struggle to see it because, you know, he's not going to get a drive at one of the top teams. And, you know, given that nothing but one of the top teams, as I said, has won a race since 2013, you know, he's going to go to a team pretty much knowing that he's not even going to win a race, let alone have a tilt at a championship. And, you know, given where he's come from and all that he's done, are you going to do that? Or are you going to, I don't know, maybe try and follow Fernando and do something in America or sports cars or just walk away entirely like Nico? I just can't see him going, all right, I'll take out the spare seat at Renault. I just can't see it myself. What about you?
It'll be very interesting to see, won't it? Yeah, a few things to say about that. First is that, well, he's still got another season, we think, if it gets going, in the Ferrari. And who knows, if that car turns out to be a gun and he wins a handful of races, perhaps we'll be talking about Sebastian Vettel very differently. And I did want, you're right to say that in a couple of recent years, he's had a very, very competitive car. And if you go back and look at the results from the first half of a couple of recent seasons, I think 17 and 18, you see that actually he was leading the championship for a good chunk of it. He was winning a lot of races, very consistently scoring podiums. But at some point during the middle of the season, it sort of crumbled and Lewis just got stronger and stronger and turned the screw.
All the Mercedes got stronger and stronger, all both.
Well, yeah. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. That's probably it.
I think, you know, that, you know, a lot of teams trying to compete with Mercedes is what they do is they go, right, OK, we are going to create the best car we possibly can. And they work their socks off over the winter and they arrive on the grid and they've it's all come good. They've got themselves a really good car and they think, wow, we're right up there. But Mercedes don't do that. You know, they turn up with their best car and then they just don't stop. And I think their ability to develop a car through a season is second to none. And, you know, Mercedes may be beaten in Australia, but come the end of the season, you know, they seem always to be up there, don't they? And they're such a complete team because, you know, they don't cock up their strategy and they don't have drivers which just, you know, fall off for no apparent reason. They just, you know, it's not about any individual lap or even about any individual race, is it? It's about a season. You know, I think they get that in a way that no other team does. And so what it means is that even when they don't have the best car, they'll either turn it into the best car or manage it in such a way that they still manage to win both titles despite not having the best car, which is extraordinary.
That, well, operationally, they're, for the most part, very, very good as well. And that's where Ferrari have gone wrong in a couple of recent seasons. You know, mistakes with tyre choices, pit stops, strategy, all that stuff. It is true that they've lost lots of points and even race wins through those sort of tactical errors. So how are we going to reflect a few years from now on Vettel's time at Ferrari, do you think? I mean, without a championship, it clearly hasn't been the success that people were hoping it would be.
Let's not mince words, it's been a failure, hasn't it? I mean, if you said to him, you know, there is no way in the world that he would have gone to Ferrari expecting anything other than, to be honest, multiple world championships. It has been a failure. But, you know, he's not, as I think you pointed out in a post, he's by no means the first world champion to go to Ferrari and discover that it's not quite what he imagined it was going to be. We came up with a list, didn't we? Prost, Mansell, Farina, various guys.
Alonso,
yeah, exactly. Went to Ferrari, you know, with world championships, you know, in some of those cases, multiple world championships already in the bag. Came home with nothing.
Mm. We also have to acknowledge that Vettel didn't go into the same Ferrari that Schumacher was able to turn Ferrari into. And I think during Vettel's time there, he worked underneath at least two team principals, might even have been three. And certainly in the early years of the turbo hybrid era, I don't think the Ferrari was quite a match for the Mercedes. So, you know, it's not just that Vettel has made mistakes and been rattled by his younger teammate as he was last season. The Ferrari hasn't been the strong outfit that he would have been hoping for.
You are right, but you know, let's cast our mind back to 96 and Michael Schumacher, you know, with his couple of titles already in the bag, goes to Ferrari, and Ferrari is 10 times the basket case that it is now. I mean, Ferrari is, in my view, the second best team out there at the moment. In 1996, it was nowhere, absolutely nowhere. And the point you make about him not having the team around him, well, yes, you're right. But the point about Michael is that he built the team. You know, he had Ross there, and he had Rory Byrne there, and Todd there, and they created this this supergroup, didn't they? And you know, okay, it took them a few years, but you know, they won the constructors in '99, and then no one else got a look in until 2005.
Yeah, among that bunch, there was unity, there was belief, there's a shared purpose. There was not a chink of light between them. They were such a strong group, weren't they?
And exactly.
No one else has been able to engineer that same situation at Ferrari
since. And I think if you are a Senna or a Schumacher, you know, I think the ability to build the team and for the team to have such total belief in you, and it becomes synergistic, because then you believe totally in the team, and you get into this circle of virtue. And you know, I think, to be honest, that's probably where Lewis is with Mercedes at the moment. I think that they are such a closely knit unit. Their standards are so high, and you know, nothing succeeds like success. And because they've done it, and let's not forget that Mercedes spent quite a long time in the wilderness before it suddenly came right for them. You know, they've learned how to do it. I think Mercedes are doing now what Ferrari did in the early part of this century.
Yeah, and at the heart of it, a talented driver who everyone believed in.
Yeah. So can we just briefly talk Danny Ric and Lando at McLaren? How exciting is that? Do you think, so here's the question, let us hope, that McLaren continues to recover from its dark, dark days, and the progression is, let's say, similar to how it's been for the last season or so. That means that in 2021, McLaren are going to turn up on a grid with Lando and with Danny and with...
And Merc engines.
Mercedes engines, exactly. I was getting to that. And, you know, suddenly... You know, it could be really interesting all of a sudden. And, you know, Lando, we haven't really talked about him. But, you know, one thing I discovered was that although Sainz completely outraced him and finished with almost twice as many points last year in sixth place, and I think Lando was 11th in the championship, you know, Sainz had 4 years under his belt before Lando got to the grid in Australia, you know, to do his first ever race. But in qualifying, Lando was actually slightly quicker. He has fractionally the better qualifying rate, which means he's got the speed.
Mm.
You know, he's got the speed to beat someone who's going to get who is, you know, as of the beginning of next season, you know, a Ferrari driver. So, you know, him, and then you chuck Danny Ric into the mix, and you know, he's an intriguing character, isn't he?
He's a great guy.
Yeah, but do great guys win world championships? I don't know. It's really, really, is he, I mean, we know he's last of the late breakers. We know he's got an enormous smile. We know that he's really, really quick over a lap. But, you know, if Lando has got, you know, real, real confidence with that season under his belt, he understands the team and everything else. And Danny, who's, what's Danny now, 30, I think. So he's not exactly ancient. He's got lots of seasons left in him, but he's not a nipper anymore. I don't know. Could be really interesting. I mean, what I hope is that they just really, really push each other along and end up being greater than the sum of their parts.
Which way is it going to go? It's going to be fascinating to find out. I really hope that the 2021 McLaren is a quick car. It would be great to see that name back, even winning races, you know.
It would be great to see any name other than, and no disrespect to Mercedes, Ferrari and Red Bull, and, you know, they've done what they've done because they're the best teams out there, but I mean, just for the sake of variety, for goodness sake, wouldn't it be, I mean, McLaren, fantastic. I mean, you know, I would love McLaren to be back up there. I'd love Williams to be back up there, but frankly, I would just love anybody to be up there because, you know, the sport needs it. It really, really does.
Yeah, you're absolutely right about that, and I just want to talk about Ricciardo a little bit more. We still, about, you know, 10-15 minutes ago, Andrew, you reeled off a list of the A-list drivers in Formula One. I think you said Hamilton, Leclerc, Verstappen, and you didn't mention Ricciardo.
No.
And so, which is an interesting point, because we don't yet know, really, do we? Does he belong at that top table? What I'm hoping more than anything is that the McLaren is quick in 2021 and we get to find out for sure.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, well, we've also said in the course of this conversation that one thing he did do is he scared off Vettel at Red Bull, didn't he?
That's true.
So, you know,
he gave a four-time world champion a fright, didn't he? A proper scare.
Well, he wiped the floor with him, to be honest.
Yeah. I remember interviewing Daniel Ricciardo a couple of years ago, just before the British Grand Prix. And he's in person the way that he comes across on television. And we were doing this roundtable interview, and somebody mentioned Sebastian Vettel, and Daniel was sat next to me, and I heard him say under his breath, "I beat him."
Yeah,
you just think it's what you'd expect your mate to say, wouldn't you, over about, you know, table football or something, but. Yeah, there's no question that he's a very, very talented guy. I hope that he finally has the machinery to, at some point, perhaps that it's the McLaren, to mount a proper title challenge, because I think he's got one in him.
Yeah, I think I may regret saying this, but I don't think he's a Lewis. You know, I think we knew from the get-go, we knew from 2007 when Lewis turned up that he was someone else. And I think that even though they haven't won titles yet, I think we know that about Leclerc and I think we know that about Max. There's a little bit of me which thinks that if he was in that category, we'd be thinking about him in that category by now, because he's been out there for quite a long time, and you know, he's done some amazing stuff, and when he's got the wind up and he's on it and he's on a mission, he's, with the possible exception of Max, he's probably the most exciting driver to watch out there. But it just hasn't, you know, cream does have a, forgive me for the terrible cliche, but cream does have a way of finding its way to the top, and he's not quite done it yet. So yeah, let's hope.
Oh, do you know what? It's fantastic after 2 months of really nothing happening to have some motorsport stuff to talk about again. It's a huge relief.
Yeah. Has it occurred to you, once things do genuinely go, just how busy we're going to be? Just how much stuff that hasn't happened, which everybody's going to try and make happen in, you know, the first 3 weeks after lockdown ends? You know, we are going to be, yeah, up to our ears, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, all those cars still need to be launched.
Can't wait, mate. Cannot bloody wait. Yeah. Got to get out of there.
Okay. Well, there we go. That's what we've done, 25 minutes almost of news chat. So let's move on to some of the recent Drive Nation posts. We'll talk about them in a bit more detail. Andrew, the first one that I want to talk about, because it's just so cool. I didn't know that you were fortunate enough to do this. But on Friday, we posted a story about you driving the Bentley Speed 8, the very car that won Le Mans in 2003. Was that right?
Yeah, absolutely. They made a few, but this was that car. Yeah, absolutely.
Bloody hell! What a privilege that was. So when did you drive this? Was it soon after 2003?
No, it was in 2019. I couldn't write about it for DN because there was an arrangement whereby it was going to go into Motorsport magazine first, but it's been and gone from there. So I'm now sort of free to write about it anywhere I like. I did also, so although I've not written about this in the Post, I did also drive their sort of latest GT3 car. And it was just, we can talk about it as much as you like, but it was just really, really interesting to contrast what a 17-year-old purpose-built sports prototype with, you know, the most brand new, but nevertheless heavily adapted road car. And yeah, I was really, really lucky. They gave me each car, and you know, nobody said, "Oh, you got to do this many laps, or you can only use these many revs, or keep off the curbs, or whatever." They just kind of trusted me to bring them back. So I was able to. And the thing about these things, and I wrote about this in the Post, and particularly with the old car, with the 2003, the prototype, you can't drive them slowly. It's really not an option because you will crash. Unless you get heat particularly into the tyres and the brakes, they're nightmares. They're horrible, horrible things to drive. They don't understand why someone's trying to drive them like that. They don't like it. And sooner or later, they'll find a way to repay your lack of respect. Like it happened to me once. This is a claim to fame. Another Le Mans winner, the 88 Group C Jaguar. They actually are nine, and maybe I'll talk about this at another time. But I drove that. But I was a lot younger and I was a lot more circumspect and frankly a lot more scared. And I didn't do my due diligence. I didn't drive it fast enough. I didn't get enough heat into it. And I spun it. And I can remember it didn't connect with anything and it was all absolutely fine. But I can remember thinking as I headed backwards towards the barrier that every single component on that car was original. And thinking, you know, if all I do is just break the rear wing, I've broken the rear wing of the car that won Le Mans in 1988. And money can put anything back apart from history. So I've disappeared off on a tangent, and doubtless up my own fundament as well. But I just found it very interesting to sort of to drive the two.
So you drove the Speed 8 at Silverstone. Which circuit?
The international circuit, so basically the bottom half of it. So you get the hangar straight and you get Stone, you get Club, and then you get a little bit of the nonsense that they added on after that before back onto the hangar straight. So you don't get Copse and Luffield and that sort of thing, but it's still a proper workout. You know, it's a circuit in its own right. It's challenging and it's fun, and it's still more than enough space to exercise a car like that.
So when with the Speed 8, once you've got some tyre temperature, the brakes are working, does it then just come to you and just feel like a complete honey?
It's all about confidence. And where I was very lucky, Guy Smith, the bloke who, one of the three who won Le Mans for them in 2003.
Good lad.
Top bloke. I've known him for a while and I completely trust him. In fact, I've been driven in another Speed 8 by him. So I've seen how he drives them, which let me be clear, it's not how I drove it. But he was there and he just said, don't worry about it. He's just said, you know, the 2001, 2002 cars were really tricky, apparently. Quite snappy, bitey. You needed to be on it. He said, and he's a 2003 car, which was a brand new car from the ground up and absolutely not related to an Audi R8, despite what so many people have said. He just said, just trust it, trust yourself, drive it fast, drive it hard, enjoy yourself. And you've got someone like that giving you those sorts of instructions with that sort of car. You know, he's not going to say it because he's kind of secretly hoping I'm going to stick it in the wall. So I just took him at his word. And it's always the same thing, isn't it? You know, you first get into it and you think, oh, I can't cope with anything. I can't begin to handle this amount of power. I don't understand how it can get through a corner this fast, and the brakes are just something else. And then, you know, if you're lucky enough to have enough time out there, it just kind of, you acclimatise. That's all it is. You just adapt. Human beings are infinitely adaptable creatures, and you just get used to it. And then once you get used to it, you can start to understand it a little bit. And it was, you know, the clouds clear, and, you know, what is just left is a simply incredible driving experience. But, you know, to be honest with you, I wasn't that scared by it, because somebody who I knew and trusted told me not to be scared. I was just, it was just one of the most exhilarating things I've ever done.
Wow, that's so cool. So compare them, the two then. So you said you also drove the current GT3 car. I'm interested to hear what they felt like back to back.
It's just really interesting. You know, one of the things I did mention in the post was, which really struck me, is that if you stuck wets on the prototype, on the Speed 8, it would still go around a corner quicker than any GT3 car on new slicks. So that's, you know, that gives you an idea of the different levels of downforce at play between, you know, having proper prototype bodywork and something that's adapted from, you know, a car, you know, you go on holiday in. The prototype is just so much more precise. It is a precision instrument, and you guide it, and you're not, you know, what you're absolutely not doing, or certainly I wasn't doing, was wrestling with it at all. The GT3 car, I mean, it's fun, but it's mobile, it moves, and you've got to manage it. You've got a lot of mass there, which you've got to control. You've got to kind of learn how to drive. You've got to learn what it wants to do. And then do that. Whereas it's somehow, in many ways, I'd say the prototype was an easier car to drive. It's certainly less physical, despite the fact you're putting far more G, because you're not getting beaten up by it. You're not being thrown around. It's just, it's so much more contained. Yes, of course, I would prefer to drive the prototype because it's a proper racing car and it won Le Mans and everything else. But the GT3 car is, I mean, yeah, proper fun, proper fun. If you like just sort of, you know, skidding about at very high speeds in something, you know, with a ridiculous amount of power, which makes an incredible noise. Yeah, I mean, fantastic. But yeah, obviously the prototype was something else again.
Yeah, I did something very similar actually a few years ago while at Evo magazine. I went to the Fiat Group test track in Bolocco in northern Italy to drive the Maserati MC12 course.
Oh, yeah.
Which was they built 12 of them, similar to sort of Ferrari FXX programs, and, you know, lots of hypercar manufacturers have their track-only sort of uprated versions of road-going hypercars, don't they? This was Maserati's, the MC12 course, and it had lots of the suspension components from the GT1 racing car. So, again, a more or less a purpose-built competition car. That's what it's designed to do. And before, it was a horrible day, soaking wet, which was kind of gutting. And the other car that they laid on for me to learn the circuit before going out in the MC12 was a Gran Turismo GT4 racing car. So again, you know, similar to what you had, a road-based competition car to sort of get my eye in a little bit. As I said, it was really wet, and I drove the GT4 car first. And it was horrible. There was no sense of what the car was doing, no feel. I felt like I had hardly any traction and grip, and I didn't know how much throttle application would cause the rear tires to spin up. I couldn't sense any of that stuff. And I got out of it thinking, oh, bloody hell, if I can't even drive a GT4 car comfortably around here, how am I going to drive this incredible MC12? And of course, when you drive the MC12, it's light years better.
know? Easier.
It's easier to drive, less intimidating. You sense and feel everything. You absolutely know how much brake pedal pressure you can put in without locking up. You know exactly how much grip and traction you've got. You just sense the whole car around you. Whereas the road-based GT4 car was just remote and difficult and hard. It was so eye-opening, that, and I'd never really considered it before, but, you know, a car that is purpose-built to go quickly around a circuit, that's what they're for, and that's why they're easier.
That's what it's good at, yeah, absolutely. I mean, you know, it shouldn't be that surprising, but it is, isn't it? Because you look at them, and they look so scary, and you just like, I don't want to sit in that, let alone try and drive it fast. and then you do, and you know, I have had this a few times, and you just get out of it, and you think, oh, all right,
yeah. That MC12 was—it's the most amazing motor vehicle I've ever driven. It was stunning. But you look at it, and it looks enormous, and you know how much it's worth. And you sit in it, and you're so reclined, and they've got this sunstrip across the windscreen that comes halfway down. And so you think, I'm not going to be able to see anything. But then it's like a switch. You start driving it and you forget about the size. You forget about the value of it. You forget that that sunstrip comes so low down the windscreen because you're just looking through that narrow slit of windscreen that's left. And you just get on with driving it. So it's so interesting. When you actually start moving in these cars, they become very different beasts to what you thought they were going to be.
I mean, I would say, not without exception, but I would say it is a very reliable rule of thumb that the things you worry about sitting in a pit lane are never the things that actually you worry about when you're out on the track. Again, you know, as you say, your ability or the human brain's ability to focus on what actually matters. You know, there's so many cars, because I'm fat and 6'4", that I've just not been comfortable in. And I thought, oh God, this is really going to hurt and I'm going to be rolling around the car. And you get out and you don't even think about it until, like, you know, maybe you get out of the car and you discover you can't stand up properly, or you're black and blue for a week. But, you know, your body just decides, well, that's not important. The only thing that's important is keeping the car on the tarmac.
Yeah. Yeah. Oh, that Maserati, God, I did love that thing. It sounds like you had an amazing time in the Bentley. Okay, let's choose a different post then. So on the 14th this month, I posted a review of a Litchfield-tuned Porsche 911 Carrera T. And really, I posted it just because I could. It's, you know, lockdown had been lifted just enough that I could get back to doing my day job. And so I just called Litchfield and I said, I'm coming up to you. I haven't driven your car in its latest guise. I just want to drive something else and get back to doing what I do for a living. I'd actually reviewed the very same car a couple of years ago for Drive Nation when it had 500 horsepower, almost 500 horsepower. It's a Carrera T that he has done some engine tuning work on, also lowered it on some KW springs and done some geometry work. And when I drove it in 2018, I just thought it's fantastic. Such a sort of cohesive, well-resolved tuner car. Quite often these tuned cars have got bundles of power, too much really. They've got stiff suspension and they feel a bit rattly or whatever. But his Carrera T was just beautifully done. And since then, he's in Litchfield. He's not a man to stand still, so he's carried on tuning his car. And he's since then fitted it with the bigger GTS turbochargers with his own billet lightweight compressor wheels that spool up much quicker, and it now has 600 horsepower in a manual rear wheel drive 911. And Andrew, as you know, only a decade ago that pretty much would have made it a GT2 RS.
Yeah, so a couple of questions. Question one, how does you know, I can remember when a car with 100 horsepower per liter was like pretty amazing, and not many could get there. And those that did were quite often fairly unpleasant because they had to be quite, you know, heavily turbocharged or whatever, and they had lots of lag. So you're now 600 horsepower from a 3-liter engine. So the question one is, you know, how does that feel? What does 200 horsepower per liter feel like these days? I mean, I'm just trying to think of other cars that do that. And I think, well, the A45 AMG is one and a Senna is another, and I can't right offhand think of a third. Second question is, did you feel in any way guilty or bad about driving a 600 horsepower car around the roads in at times? I only mention this because I've been chatting a bit to our mate Chris Harris, and he's been saying that for the first time in years, he's driving around the place quite slowly because it just doesn't seem to him to be very appropriate to be, or even less appropriate than usual, to be screaming about the place. Did you feel self-conscious about it at all, or was it just like, well, hey, let's go?
I understand that point of view. I do get it. It didn't trouble me too much, I have to be honest. I didn't really go far, and I was, as we always try to be, very sensible about where and when I used all that power. Of course, you try not to blast past other cars fully lit. You know, I totally get where Mr. Harris is coming from with that. To be honest, after 2 months out of the saddle, I was just delighted to get back in a car and be driving it and thinking about what it was telling me and thinking about how the engine was working. And it was such a huge relief. And yeah, you're right to point out that figure of 200 horsepower per litre. It's just a staggering number, isn't it? And what's most remarkable about the work that Licho has done is that the engine is so tractable. He didn't want it to be an on-off, very boosty motor, like as you'd expect of 200 horsepower per litre. It's so linear. It just comes in at, from 2000 RPM it starts pulling, and then just pulls in a perfectly linear way, and it just keeps on rising and building up until about 7,500 RPM. And it's not a stroppy, moody engine at all. It doesn't... I couldn't believe that it was only a little 3 litre motor in the back there. It felt like, I mean, Porsche has never put a very, very high displacement engine in the back of a 911 because, you know, no bigger than 4 litres. But it felt like what a 911 would feel like with a huge, normally aspirated motor in it. It was incredible the work that he's done with it, frankly.
It's not a king's ransom to get the conversion done, is it?
No, it's 11,000 pounds, which includes the chassis stuff as well. So you know, if you've got it can be done to any 991 Carrera, but his is a Carrera T, and I had a look. You can buy a Carrera T for just under 70,000 pounds. Do 11 grand's worth of work on it and bang. I mean, you've got a hell of a car there.
For less than the price of a new Carrera, standard Carrera.
Exactly. Yeah. Frankly, I don't know if you need 600 horsepower in a road car, but there are people out there who do want it, so why not? Okay, let's choose one more post to start winding up this podcast. It was on May 7th that I posted something about my sort of curiosity about motorcycles. I've never ridden a motorbike. When I was 16, I had a 49cc scooter, which topped out at a mighty 35 miles per hour. But I wrote that post because it occurred to me that when I turned 17, I didn't even cross my mind to look into carrying on the process of getting my bike licenses. I just ditched two wheels entirely because I was so excited about getting on four. But I wonder, Andrew, where do you stand on motorbikes? I mean, I know you lost a dear friend of yours, Henry Hope Frost, when he was riding a motorcycle a couple of years ago.
Do you know, it's funny, before Henry's accident, I was starting to wobble. A lot of people listening to this will know a bloke called Colin Goodwin, who frankly is a bloody menace. because he's been riding bikes all his life, and he seemed to have dedicated a small portion of the latter part of it trying to persuade me to do the same. And, you know, I have a few feelings on the subject. I mean, I love the idea. I had a mate when I was young who had a bit of money, and he had some bikes. And this is like when I was a teenager and I lived in Jersey. And I just used to go out on his bikes completely illegally and go roaming around the island. But I haven't ridden a bike since then. What has happened is actually when I was quite young, somebody else I knew died. Somebody lost an arm. My brother, my oldest brother, had quite a bad motorcycle accident. And the one thing that even an idiot 20-year-old me could understand with all these various accidents is that none of them, just like Henry's, were the fault of the bloke on the bike. And I'm just not very comfortable with that. You know, if I go around a corner too fast and fall off and hurt myself, you know, when I'm racing something or whatever, then, you know, that goes with the territory and it's my fault, and I can understand that. But when you are so much so much of the peril that you face has got nothing to do with you, it's always put me off that, and probably just as much the fact that I know me reasonably well, and I fear very much that I would want to ride a bike faster than my talent would advise. And again, if you do that in a car, the likelihood is it's going to be embarrassing and expensive and maybe inconvenient. But on a bike, you know, you and I both know people who've had big bike accident. I mean, really, really big bike accidents where it's been touch and go for a bit. And, you know, I think that as a man in his 50s, for me to, you know, having had no prior experience, almost no prior experience, no prior experience of any value, to get on the bike now, I'd have to do it on the basis that I was just going to poodle about the place. And I don't want to poodle about the place. I want to, you know, I want to enjoy my time on the road. So I think I'll do it on four wheels.
I'm still in two minds about it. I mean, the response to that post was amazing. There were 220 comments, almost all of them long and thoughtful and insightful. So clearly it's something that, you know, plenty of car people think about. And I remain curious about it because, well, I know people who have started riding and they say the sensation of it is incredible. And I remember when I was 16 and I had my little 49cc scooter, that I loved the sensation of flowing along a country road in it when, you know, on a summer's day, even at 35 miles per hour. That's why I'm curious about bikes, and I sort of wonder about whether or not I should get my license. But as you've just been, you know, setting out, on the flip side, there are so many reasons to not bloody do it, frankly.
Yeah. I also have a family. I have an incredibly accommodating family, which, you know, particularly my missus, who's never in any way suggested that I shouldn't get into any racing car or do anything, any of the, you know, silly things that, you know, we're lucky enough to get to do over the years. But, you know, and she'd never say you can't have a bike, but I just know, and I completely understand why. She just wouldn't be comfortable with it. And I'm not that selfish. I'm fairly selfish, but I'm not that selfish that, you know, knowing that I'm just going to go, well, don't care, I'm going to go and do it anyway. And I think it would just, I think if I got one, you know, it would obviously cost a lot to get the right bit of paperwork, and then you've got to all buy the gear, and then you've got to go and get the bike. And I think it would just be another one of those things that sits in my shed and makes me feel guilty about having it and not using it.
Two more things to say on this topic. It's all moot anyway, because Imogen, my other half, has made it quite clear that I'm not allowed one. So there we go. and the other thing to say is a common friend of ours, Andrew, messaged me on WhatsApp the moment that post went live. I won't say who it is. He was saying, stay the F off bikes. He rides motorbikes, but he doesn't sort of make that public knowledge. He doesn't actually want people to know, or at least he used to ride them until a couple of years ago, a car pulled out on him and he ran into it and he hurt himself.
Yeah. I think I know who it is.
Yeah. So when I hear those stories, I just think, four wheels.
Yeah. But in theory, I love the idea of being that exposed. I love the idea of the power to weight ratio. Those incredible. When I was a kid in the 70s, and the Japanese, you know, suddenly got on top of superbikes, and, you know, and you were getting these amazing things with these beautiful engines that, you know, would spin up to 11, 12,000 RPM. And I was just, I was absolutely in love with the idea. And to an extent, there's a bit of me that still is. But I think for me, and in my particular circumstances, and largely because I'm an idiot, I just wouldn't trust myself.
Yeah, maybe we'll keep admiring them from afar. Okay, so I didn't tell you, Andrew, that we were going to discuss this, but I think I just want to do 2 minutes on this one other post.
Oh, God.
And then we'll finish it.
Go on.
Who won Le Mans in 1965?
So, it depends who you believe. It was definitely Jochen Rindt and the Kansas Flash Maston Gregory. They were definitely driving a North American racing team Ferrari 250 LM. So I think what you're referring to is whether a bloke called Ed Hugus was part of that driver lineup too. If you didn't see the post or can be bear to be bored with it again, this was a car which had no hope of winning because there were lots of Ferrari and Ford prototypes ahead. It qualified 11th. Jochen Rindt and Maston Gregory at either ends of their careers didn't really want to be in it because it was a bit of a no-hoper. But it was just one of those races where everything broke. There were 14 classified finishes at the end out of a grid of over 50. They found themselves in second place at dawn and, yeah, went on to win the race. But, so the question is, years and years later, this bloke, Ed Hugus, who was a really good, capable driver, did lots and lots of stuff and was absolutely the reserve driver for that car, and one of Nart's trusted hands. He claimed that in the middle of the night, Maston Gregory came in and he didn't have very good eyesight and he wore big thick specs and he had trouble seeing at night and he was exhausted. Jochen Rindt, not expecting to get in the car, was having a kip and they needed someone. Maston Gregory refused to go back out again, and so this bloke Ed Hugas got in and did a sneaky night stint, all of which was legal. But if you use your reserve driver, he replaces one of your drivers, which would have been Jochen Rindt. So the moment that Rindt got back in the car, had any of this been known, the car would have been disqualified. And so he wasn't on the podium. Nobody talked about it. And obviously, given the potential for disqualification, it's completely understandable why he wasn't on the podium and nobody talked about it. And the question as to whether he actually drove the car or not has raged ever since. He always maintained that he did. If you look in the Bible of sports car racing, Time and Two Seats by Janos Vimfen, you will find that he's listed as a driver. There are a couple of very reputable websites I use for data, and he's listed there too. But Coco Canetti, Luigi Canetti, who ran the North American racing team, who was there, and he said that he absolutely didn't believe that Hugas drove the car. And Doug Nye, who I defer to in all things when it comes to Ferraris and history, has dismissed the story as total garbage. So, don't know.
A great tale, though, isn't it?
It's a good tale, yeah. Can you imagine being part of a drive out that won Le Mans and not being able to talk about it at all? Not being able to celebrate, not being able to, you know, wow.
I hope it's true, at least.
Yeah, I hope it's true, but I don't think it is, you know. I don't think it is. I mean, let's put it this way. If he wasn't such a liked and respected person, I don't think anybody would have believed it. I think the only reason people did believe it was because he was such a well-liked and respected person, and he was that car's reserve driver. So, yeah, maybe, but on balance, I think probably not.
So when are you going to come clean and admit that you did do a night stint for Bentley in 2003?
Shush! I thought we weren't going to talk about that.
Fair enough. We'll leave that there. Well, let's wrap it up then. Andrew, thank you for your time. That was a good, fun podcast.
Yeah, I enjoyed that.
Yeah, I think we're going to have to work out what we do next week, aren't we? If there's some more interesting topical stuff, perhaps we'll do this again, or maybe we'll do an hour on how to be a car journalist or something.
Yeah, well, there's always stuff to talk about, isn't there?
Always stuff. Thank you all for listening. Please remember to subscribe to the podcast wherever you get them. It really does help us. Also, leave a review, leave a rating, tell your friends, tell your mum if she likes cars. Please spread the word. It all helps. And we'll talk to you again a week from now.
A lot can happen in 3 years, like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage that lasts nearly 3 years in some states. Learn more at uh1.com.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Hi, this is Craig Robinson from Ways to Win, and support for this podcast comes from Invesco QQQ, the official ETF of the NCAA. The future isn't scary, not realizing its potential, however, could be. Just like on the recruiting trail, I've seen potential come in many forms as a coach. Learn more at Invesco.com/QQQ. Let's rethink possibility. Invesco Distributors, Inc.